Yes, we're always tied up with the idea of working while it is light. Because the light comes and no man can work. When you are rehearsing a situation, which is not actually present, then you can work out the best way of dealing with it. But if you wait till the situation arises before you work out how to deal with it, you will probably not be able to deal adequately with it at all. Remember we said that Napoleon was once asked by one of his lieutenants why he always knew the best thing to do in a new situation. And he replied, the situation is not new to me. I have already rehearsed all possible contingencies, he said. Then whatever contingency appears, it brings forth the appropriate response. This ties up with that other question we had before about being and knowledge. Supposing I draw a sphere. I'll put an equator on it so you can get a perspective idea, and I'll put a highlight on it. Shade it. Now pretend that is a balloon. We can, if we wish, paint onto the balloon knowledge. Now imagine that inside the balloon there is sentiency, aware that something has just painted knowledge on its skin. But inside the balloon there is no substantial equivalent of the sign of knowledge on its skin surface. So if we say knowledge is the product of formal stimulation from without, then unless we can carry this knowledge, this formal stimulus, into the depths of the being and equip it with energy, in other words, establish it with mass inertia, it is not being substance. It is only being superficial. And there is frequently a lack of definition about being in philosophy. We have said that being is circumscription. And when I draw a circle on the plane of the paper, that is being in one dimension, namely in the plane of the paper only. If I want to turn that into three-dimensional being, I must make another rotation and another one. Those three rotations, at right angles to each other, will constitute a threefold being, a being with three dimensions. But owing to the fact that those rotations don't go to the dead center, where they are will constitute a skin, and any modification of that skin produced by a stimulus will only constitute superficial knowledge. If we want to make that knowledge substantial, we must, by the meaning of the word substance, put it underneath that surface and cause the energy of the stimulus to penetrate deeper and deeper And every time it goes round, again in the three dimensions, it produces a deeper level of being. So that we can say that being is circumscription, and substantial being is a circumscription within a circumscription. And the greater the number of energies you have rotating round, and the more of them you can pack towards the center in these three dimensions, the more approximating to the solid that being is. A man that knows only the superficial terms of a science is said not to be very solid in his knowledge. And if he meditates upon the logical implications of it and has exposed himself to various stimulus situations, then energy is packed in deeper and deeper and deeper into his substance until he becomes an embodiment of the knowledge relevant to that subject. We would then say he has substantial being. He has a being able to deal with the stimulus, as opposed to merely a superficial being, which could only deal with the most external aspects of it. So, when we consider this balloon being, it's something like an egg from which a child develops. The stimulus that comes from outside and imparts form to it, whichever angle it comes at, there's some more knowledge going another way. The stimulus that disturbs the surface of that being must be taken in by the being. The being must actually want it to go inside itself. It must draw it into itself by an act. In other words, there must be something in the nature of the stimulus that the deepest part of the being wants into itself. And if it is relevant to the life purpose of that being, the being will draw it in. And then, the more stimuli coming from outside are dragged in, and the deeper they're dragged in, the more substantiated in knowledge that being becomes. The idea of the Vajra, of the thunderbolt man we've mentioned before, is the same thing as the idea of the man compacted in knowledge. The Saturnine man, who has taken all the knowledge, you know, Saturn, Kronos, is that god also of wisdom, the packing in the time process of experience, driving it ever deeper and deeper inside the being. Now, once a being has been stimulated at all, then the substance of that being will never vibrate again in quite the same way. So after the first stimulus, all subsequent stimuli are interfered with by the prior stimulus. Remember, memory is simply the continuance of stimulus energy in the being. So, supposing there is a stimulus giving a pattern inside here of triangularity, and it is repeated continuously until the whole being tends to assume the form of a triangle. This we could demonstrate with the appropriate apparatus and show that we can, by using stimuli from various points, cause such a modification of the being that we could turn a spherical being into a being of another shape, like a cubic being or a pyramidal being, by simply applying forces to it in different positions. Now, once the being has become habituated to receiving in a certain way, then any subsequent stimulus coming to it must be reflected inside it according to the now law of its being. Let's say the law of being for any being is that necessary mode of motion which must serve as the ground into which all new stimuli descend. So that if a being had no motion in it at all, there would be no law. It would be free. But if a motion is established and repeats itself, that motion constitutes a law of the being. such that any stimulus coming inside and assimilating into that prime motion would be a logical implication of the law of that being. And any stimulus coming to it, which could not assimilate with that motion, the prime motion, would be rejected by the prime motion.
He would interpret it in the terms of the
of the existing notion.
So
whatever the nature of the prime stimulus, all subsequent stimuli from whatever positions they come are conditioned by the prime stimulus. So if we get one stimulus coming and then another one, and the two have some points of similarity, they assimilate together and make a complex. Gradually, by the repetition of similar stimuli and assimilation of those together, there is built up within a conceptual mechanism. Every stimulus is like a percept. Many similar percepts running together establish a concept. A percept implies a cutting, a rational cutting out of the whole of possibility. And a concept is the gathering together of many percepts with some similar factor. So the conceptual mechanism within will condition every subsequent stimulus. Now, if your primary concept, built out of many similar percepts, is out of phase with reality, then any new idea coming to you must automatically be misinterpreted. This means that if you want to get to the truth of any stimulus situation, either you will have been fortunate enough to have had the right education in the first place, or you will have to break down the conceptual mechanism you've already got. Now, we said that when the stimulus comes from outside, if the entity under consideration finds that stimulus suitable for its life purpose, it will allow entrance to the stimulus. It will draw it in. And the more essential it is to its purpose, the deeper it will take it. So when it has built up a conceptual mechanism, the fact that it has accepted those percepts is evidence that it appeared at the time of assimilation to further the purpose of that being. But if subsequently it becomes apparent that what has been assimilated does not apply, then there will be a necessity for breaking up that conceptual mechanism. And here it isn't a moral question of good or evil, because we can easily see that a child brought up in a primitive society might develop a conceptual mechanism, namely a system of social taboos, which would be perfect for the tribe in which it was brought up, but which on its travelling to another country, so-called civilised, more advanced, it would then find itself at a conceptual disadvantage. We know, for instance, that the vocabularies of certain of the African people have no abstract ideas in them. They have no words expressing abstract ideas. They have many words, particular words, for particular kinds of vegetable organism, for which we have the name tree, but they have no name tree. Because tree is an abstract idea. So they can recite you a dozen names and indicate what to us is a tree concept with varieties, but to them, they're particulars. They haven't developed the abstract concept. Now, in their environment, it is better for them to have this perceptual, non-abstract way of looking at things, because each particular tree has a use to them, and the name is the name of the function of that tree. Some are medicinal, some are for firewood, some are for building, and so on. Just as if we pointed and said medicine, and said firewood, and said building, and a European would say, those are all trees. Well, we wouldn't be interested in their tree nature at that level. So many of the Africans who are without abstract ideas, in the concrete situation of their own environment, would give a better account of themselves than a university educated Englishman with a mind full of abstract ideas. In other words, they'd be more in contact with the perceptual environment and get along quite well without the concept. But when we remove them into a civilized state, everything would go out of phase. There would be none of the things that they are used to and to which they can respond simply. And the whole of the civilization in which they would find themselves would be one in which abstract ideas dominated everything. And it would be very hard for such a person to learn that all those different things were all called by the same name. You remember Gurdjieff on one occasion made a joke about the foolishness of the English being obvious from the fact that the name of the bottom of the foot and their most important psychic content was the same, namely the soul. So if we use the word soul for the fundamental at the base of the leg and of the mental existence, then some confusion could arise. But if we can show that the soul of the foot is called soul because it is fundamental, and the soul inside the human being is called soul because it is fundamental, then it would not be a joke anymore, but simply an example of an abstract idea spread rather widely. So when we get this idea of an incoming stimulus arriving into an existing conceptual pattern, if the existing conceptual pattern will not fit all environments whatever, then at some point on entering into an environment there will be a clash, and the energy of the internal concept will reject the external perceptual fact. And if it rejects the fact, it must fail. Facts are things that cannot be contradicted. So if a man ignores a fact because he has a conceptual mechanism built in a society where his conceptual mechanism works, and it had no facts to contradict it, and now finds itself in a new environment with new facts which do contradict it, then his mechanism must be altered, because the fact cannot be altered. So we, as earthbound beings, used to gravity, that is, used to a sensation of up and downness and the pressure on our feet, will be somewhat disorientated unless we prepare ourselves, if we are shot into interplanetary space and find that we have no such pressure on our feet, then the pressure points in all directions. So there's no up or down for us. Now, if we have the concept that there is always and invariably an up and a down, and the down is where my feet are, and I know it because there's a pressure, then when I get in an environment where there is no pressure on my feet and no up and downness, I will panic. And I will throw out all the perceptual evidence that says there are no such feelings and no gravity, because I will have pinned my faith in my concept. Which means that we have to give a very superior kind of authority to the percept. If there is a genuine percept disagreeing with the concept, we must modify the concept. That's why in the March of Science, even one percept contradicting the rule, no matter how many supported it, one percept has been enough to overthrow the validity of the theory as a universal. Because one exception breaks the rule. So in controlling this fact, we must aim at building a conceptual mechanism which is true of all possible worlds whatever. If we can make a conceptual mechanism that will apply to every conceivable situation, we will not need to alter it. Whereas if we make one that applies only in many situations, and not in all, when we have some adequate response ready. If we use the five-pointed star to signify the five sense life, we know that the five orders of stimuli that we get convey certain energies and therefore motions to our substance and give rise to five orders of percepts, from which, by similarities, we build up certain concepts. But that five-sense mechanism has five big gaps between them. Gaps where many motions exist, but the five sense organs give no cognizance of those motions whatever. The fact that there is a gap in frequency between seeing and hearing is enough to show that a large amount of reality is not included in sense data. So if we just confine ourselves to the five-pointed star as our conceptual guide, we would automatically be in error, because there would be so many things unaccountable for us and therefore uncontrollable by us that we should constantly get out to face. For instance, those materialists who use the five-pointed star as a symbol, like the Americans and the Russians, cannot allow that there is anything in between the five sense organs and completely inaccessible to the five sense organs. As a matter of fact, they're in a self-refuting position today, because they have means of analysis with various machines which show that large numbers of frequencies exist between the five senses, which the man, as a five-sense being, cannot possibly know. And yet it is known that they exist because they produce responses in machines which translate those motions down to a level where they can be perceived by a sense only. The various frequencies way over the frequencies of light, which we can demonstrate to exist by stepping them down into readings on a dial. We bring them down to the sense level, but we do not bring them down, we bring a translation on them. And they give evidence that there are colossal ranges of frequencies quite outside the range of the five sense organs. So we have to say that to complete the image, we must draw a circle around the five-pointed star and remember that the arcs in between each pair of sense organs represent large numbers of frequencies unknown to the five sense organs themselves. The symbol then becomes a little more adequate. But this diagram of the five-pointed star is one in which you can make a continuous line right round the five-pointed star, and therefore it is a diagram about continuous stimulation and interrelation of stimuli. There's a relation between the five senses such that a stimulus of one produces a stimulus in the others, and there's a relation such that if two are stimulated, another one opposite to them is stimulated also by the joint action of those two. So that five-pointed star is giving us a symbol of a kind of activity where energy continuously runs around the sense organ mechanism. Now when we use the concept of the two interlaced triangles, we are using a symbol that signifies forces that cannot remain continuous. We can go around this triangle, and no matter how often we go around it, we cannot persuade it to go onto the other triangle. The two triangles are quite other. So in this six-pointed star, which is really two triangles interlaced, we see that we cannot get a continuous flow of energy from one triangle to the other, and therefore there is symbolized for us a duality of total otherness. So instead of the continuous flow of energy like we have in the five sense organ mechanism, we have something discontinuous. One triangle represents matter and the other triangle represents spirit. And there's an absolute otherness between them such that you cannot make the one into the other. And yet they both have been. Now we cannot make the body of the sea into the waves of the sea, because the percept of the wave is simply a percept of a motion. the motion is not the substance, but it is of the substance. But it is not itself the substance. We can conceive the substance without that kind of motion in it, but we cannot conceive that motion without a substance. So one is dependent on the other, and yet they're totally other. Now when we assert two things that they are totally other, and yet in relation we are being, in the Aristotelian sense, illogical. But instead of calling it illogical, we call it paradoxical. Because in fact, whatever the sea is and the waves are upon it, the wave motion and the sea are totally other. One is a mere appearance, and the other is a being. When we go round one of the triangles, symbolizing the substance of it, and another the motion of it, then we have a concept of total otherness. And yet they both cohere within reality. We get it in the word real, between the letter R and the letter L, which signify exactly opposite concepts. The L signifies the body of the ocean, and the R signifies the ripples upon it. Both R and L are mid-palatal consonants. They're made in the same place, except that the R is made by the tongue hitting, vibrating against the palate continuously, and in the L it is just wiped once. So that the R means to differentiate and the L means to link or tie together. And the real involves the tying together of othernesses. So the real is itself already paradoxical. Remember, doxy is opinion, para means beyond. So paradox means beyond opinion. An opinion is not the same thing as truth. It is simply a belief about what may be true. It is not the truth. The truth is always paradoxical, necessarily so. Because there must be some unity about it, in order that we may assimilate it to ourselves, and there must be some otherness about it in order that it could create a difference in consciousness for us to know. So we need a concept, if we're going to find one, suitable for all environments, which is necessarily paradoxical. It must be one that can account for the differences and the similarities of all things. So we use this polarized diagram of the total otherness of the triangles, put a circle around it to signify the essential unity of the totally other. Then we have a symbol of a concept that is more far-reaching than this one. And we find another quality. If we go around the edge of the six-pointed star, all the way around, you see, we cannot get onto the inner center. We start at one point, go down, round. Once we've gone round, the six-pointed, we cannot go round the hexagon in the middle. So we have a totally other concept again. When we're going on the five-pointed one, in the act of going from point to point, we circumscribe the pentagon in the middle, which represents the mind, or sense common to the five separate organs. But when we go round the six-pointed star, we leave the hexagon in the middle untouched, and we have to jump from this polarized diagram, we must make a leap to the hexagon in the middle. And that hexagon, that six-sided figure, symbolizes being itself. And that is the diamond body that the Buddhists talk about. So if we understand the nature of this polarization of being action, then we have a concept bigger, more useful, applicable over a wider field. If we understand it properly, we'll discover that it necessarily operates in all possible worlds. The six-pointed one gives us the radial mode of splitting that circle spontaneously by the geometry of the circle itself into the six-pointed star and kept the perimeter exactly equally, and thus so necessarily. Whereas we cannot with a pair of compasses cut the circle into five by using the very measure, namely the radial measure, that created the circle. So to put a five-pointed star in there, if we confine our attention only to that circle, is purely arbitrary. Whereas to put a six-pointed one in here is not arbitrary, it is an inherent quality of the circle itself. Consequently, we say that this six-pointed one is a superior symbol to the five-pointed one. Now, we've often drawn this human being with the five on the outside. We'll put the triangle of the intellect there. We'll have the pentagon inside the five-pointed star to symbolize the common sense, and we'll have a hole inside the six-pointed star to signify immanent spirit, and we'll have the immanent spirit being identical with the transcendent spirit, so that there's a wave of spirit going through there, and on reaching the centre of that being, it simply receives the name immanent. But it is the same spirit which is transcendent, which on passing the centre is called immanent spirit. So there is no separation whatever between those two. And the frequency of that transcendent spirit is such that none of these closed frequencies can impede it. So there is nowhere whatever in existence where that frequency, the other frequency, is excluded. Whereas, once we've drawn the circumscribed limit, then that limit is stimulable by other beings contingent upon it, touching its edges in a contingent relation, vibrations arise. And the vibrations may be many. I've drawn this one in such a way, and this one, that the touching of this circle by the other circles does not coincide with the terminals of the five sense organs, so that the stimulation of this being by the other two does not result in a formal act of one of the five sense organs, but it results in a vague feeling instead of a specialized organic response from one of the five senses. There is a vague awareness that something is going on. Something has altered. Now, whatever the nature of the frequency of the stimulus, if it does not go onto the sense organ immediately, nevertheless, by the law of harmonics, it must have some resonance relation with some kind of stimulus that has already arisen from a direct action on a sense organ. And the result is that from this non-sense organ stimulus, from this general feeling, by harmonic law, some resonances re-stimulate the memory of something derived from a five-sense organ response. Let's say that the sense organ response is specific and the other one for this purpose is general, then there are some resonance relations between the general and the specific motions of that being. We can see then that it is possible for a sense organ stimulus memory to be stimulated by a stimulus that cannot actually stimulate that organ directly. And the arising of such formal activities in the mind not from direct sense organ stimulation, is what we would call unaccountable fantasy. We haven't seen it, we haven't touched, heard it, smelled or tasted it before, and nevertheless, somehow or other, we are presented with it. That is, a fantasy arising from stimulation of a non-specific character.
In a dream, or
As in a dream. Many dreams are caused by
where you have a dream of something which you have no memory of ever having experienced that in this particular existence.
Yes, well, we'll have to examine the nature of that now. We said that if an egg is stimulated for the first time, if there is such a thing as a first time for the egg to be stimulated, then it is legitimate to call that egg a tabula rasa, a plain sheet, something not yet drawn on, if there is such a time. As far as we're concerned, it is an abstract idea with no concrete existential significance at all, because there never was an egg of a human being yet that wasn't stimulated before it left its parent's body, and was from the beginning, as part of its parent's body, already under stimulation before it was an egg. That is, before the prime egg splits into the two parts, the somatic body making and the sex cell, already the whole protoplasm of the human race backwards to Adam is created in such a way that it is inconceivable that it could be a plain sheet, because it is a rotation of force. And in the act of coming to be, it has already involved a motion character in the act of coming to be. So it is not and cannot be a plain sheet. So those philosophers, of which the English are typical, who postulate this tabula rasa, this plain sheet, are being very, very abstract and totally unreal. For it to exist as a being, force has involved itself, and that force is moving. So that on the so-called first stimulus from without, that stimulus is not arriving in a total vacuum, but it is arriving in an already existent motion pattern, which must from the first act upon the incoming stimulus energy and alter it in some way. The mode of its alteration is what we mean when we say we are interpreting a stimulus. To interpret a stimulus is simply to let the inner motions of your being act upon it, and for you to watch the result of the action. So, we're now beginning to arrive somewhere towards the governing concept for all possible worlds. There are no beings other than beings that are made by forces rotating. It is inconceivable that any existential being whatever, in any world whatever, could ever come to be without making a closure. If it doesn't close, then there is no existent being. And if it does close, then immediately it becomes subject to the great law of pi. No matter what else happens, this must occur, this breaking into radial relations. So we can say that for all conceivable beings, in all conceivable worlds, the law of pi operates and every being must split in that radial manner. And those things which are legitimate implications of those radial vibrations are all that we need to know to deal with all possible worlds. Now, primary polarity, represented in the two triangles interlaced, says that the occupier of space, which is power, must be viewed independently of the motion of that power. And when we are viewing the motion of the power, we are talking about form, pattern, or idea. We put down power, consciousness, and consider the implications of these. This is the awareness aspect, and that is the causal aspect. Now, although in European causation theory, there is always the idea of a linear series like this, like billiard balls touching each other on the table, such that if you hit one end, the impact travels through and knocks one off the other end. That's a linear concept of causation. Now Hume, thinking about causation, defined it as the invariable sequence of events. Invariable sequence, such that when things invariably happen in the same way, the prior incidents are considered to be causes of the posterior ones. So if it invariably happens that banging of the billiard ball at this end results in one flying up at the other end a short time afterwards, if invariably, then that is the significance of the word causation to David Hume. Kant denied this and said that we couldn't postulate the idea of causation from invariable sequence unless we had an idea of causation already in our mind. And if you think about it very carefully, Hume, within the definitions he adopted, was quite right, because a baby has no idea of causation whatever. It lives in a magical world. It thinks anything can happen until it discovers that invariably it doesn't, that only certain things happen. And then it gets the idea that only when you apply a force does something occur in the nature of what we call change. And that change, internal to consciousness, constitutes the world of phenomena. Now power and consciousness are two different terms. And like we said about the two triangles, we cannot, by any stretch of the imagination, telescope those two together. They are totally other, the concept of power and the concept of consciousness. And yet the fact is that both are presenting. We know what we mean by consciousness, and we know what we mean by power. Consciousness is the very ground whereby we know anything whatever. But power is the very ground of there being things to know. That is cause. But instead of using the serial concept of the billiard balls striking each other, we'll use the Indian metaphysical concept of cause and say that the effect is simply the cause involved. So that power involving turning in is effect. Effect is ex fact, fact outwards. So if two powers involve, they make themselves rotating beings, and then from the point of view of consciousness identified with either, an impact with the other is evidence of a fact, a force act. Force act external to whichever one is doing the considering. So if this is A and this is B, then if the being A is aware of a change of its action not initiated by itself, it must postulate that that change has a cause external to itself. And it could not give rise to the concept of cause unless it felt within itself power. Cause means power. If we didn't feel that we could make an effort to contract a muscle, punch something, concern has existence, fear of situations, you would be right nearly 100% of the time.
If you go into that, you can have a lot of capacity.